Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jeff Clark, President and CEO of Northern California Public Broadcasting, the parent company of KQED. I'm also pleased to serve as a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, retired Army four-star General Wesley Clark, former presidential candidate, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, and author of A Time to Lead. Wesley Clark was born in Chicago in December 1944, the only child of Vannetta and Benjamin Caney. His father, a prosecutor, Democratic politician, and World War I veteran, died when Wesley was a young child. He and his mother then moved to Little Rock, where they lived in a rented house with his grandparents while his mother got a job as a secretary in a bank. Using his father's deceased veterans' benefits, they bought a small house where Wes grew up and became a star swimmer and top student at Little Rock's Hall High School. In 1954, his mother married Victor Clark, who became Wes's stepfather. In 1962, he was admitted to the United States Military Academy and began a 38-year career of public service in the United States Army. As a 25-year-old Army captain in Vietnam, commanding a mechanized infantry company, his bravery in battle earned him a Silver Star. After his initial 8-year obligation was completed, General Clark made the decision to stay in the Army, which led to a wide range of assignments, including the command of battalions in Colorado and Germany, service as the commander of the Army's National Training Center during the Persian Gulf War, and 3 emergency deployments to Kuwait as the commanding general of Fort Hood's 1st Cavalry Division. In 1994, General Clark was named Director for Strategic Plans and Policy for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And in 1997, after serving as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Southern Command, General Clark was selected for one of the top posts in the military, Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, a position first held by General Eisenhower. After retiring from the Army, Clark sought the White House during the last election because he said he wanted to bring a less hawkish perspective to the White House. Today, we look forward to his perspectives on a number of fronts, including but certainly not limited to U.S. foreign policy, the war in Iraq, and the 2008 presidential race. Please join me in welcoming General Wesley Clark to San Francisco and to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I see a lot of old friends out here, and it's just great to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I'm on a book tour, and I did write this book, A Time to Lead. I wrote it at the behest of a West Point classmate, and I was on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart about 2 weeks ago, and he said, "So let me get this straight. You ran for president 4 years ago. You didn't write a book. Now you're not running for president, and you've written a book, and it's entitled A Time to Lead." He said, "What gives?" And I explained to him, I really wanted to write a book about America. And that's what I tried to write about through my own experiences in my life. I can't get through an airport without people asking me, what are we going to do about Iraq, and what are we going to do about America? And there's no simple answer. You can't just pop out a algebraic equation and answer that question. You have to go back and ask, how did we get to where we are, and who are we as Americans? So let me try to tackle both those in a way and then set the stage for your dialogue, because I really want to hear what's on your mind. The beginning of all this problem that we're in with Iraq and Afghanistan and the war on terror and all the rest is it's not with the birth of Mohammed, and it's not with the founding of the State of Israel. It's actually 1989. It was the year of miracles in Europe. It was the year in which the Berlin Wall came down. It was the year in which the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe collapsed. It was the year in which we are generally credited with having won the Cold War. We won the Cold War with an integrated civil, political, diplomatic, economic, and military strategy that was calling upon all of America's resources and strengths to contain the expansion of communism and deter the use of Soviet military power. Now, it was true that Republicans and Democrats never totally agreed on this. The strategy was actually formulated in the late 40s by Harry Truman, and it was carried on by Eisenhower. And Republicans always believed we should have more weapons and talk tougher and threaten more people and do more covert operations. And Democrats always said, can't we be nicer and have more negotiations and can't we sign more treaties and don't be nasty? But there was a broad common agreement that this was America's purpose in the world. And within that agreement, then, Democrats and Republicans fought it out. And so Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, and Reagan all carried this strategy forward until the Soviet Union collapsed. People my age in the armed forces, I was commissioned in 1966. My first experience in Germany was 1964 as a cadet. I had a tank platoon with 19 soldiers and five tanks in Germany to command for the summer of 1964. We went to the divided city of Berlin. We went to Checkpoint Charlie. We went down Karl Marx Strasse in East Berlin. We saw the crumbling facades of this cheap communist architecture. We saw the angry, militant, thin faces of these East German border policemen. We saw the mines and the Berlin Wall. We were told and received the intelligence briefings about the four East German divisions who were locked and cocked in their barracks, locked up with their officers, with their equipment uploaded, ready to attack on 2 hours' notice, and behind them, two Russian armies of a dozen divisions loaded with tanks, ready to get to the Rhine River in less than 72 hours. Behind that, more armies, more troops, and ultimately 6,000 warheads pointed at America, nuclear warheads. That was the world we grew up in. It was unthinkable to us that we would win. I mean, we always wanted to win, and there was an American diplomat named George Kennan who wrote this paper called The Sources of Soviet Conduct, which he said if you just hold on and squeeze them long enough, eventually they'll collapse of their own mistaken ideas. But nobody was willing to take a bet on it and say it's going to happen in X year. I even went to Colin Powell in the summer of 1989. He was coming in to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and my friend Bill Odom was going to go in and brief him, and I said, General Odom, take this message into General Powell from me, and because I had worked for him and he knew me and respected me. I said, tell him he should set a goal like this would be the end of the Berlin Wall during the 4 years he's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And a couple of days later, I got a note back from General Odom. He says, no, General Powell says that's too ambitious a goal. And 4 months later, the Berlin Wall was down. We couldn't believe it. And within 2 years, the Soviet Union had collapsed. We won the greatest victory of the 20th century. We won it without ever having fought the Russians directly. We won it because we built our economy, and Eisenhower said America's greatest strength was our economic strength. We took our military and trained them, but we told them that their real purpose was to deter war, not to fight war. We took our educational system and we tried to sharpen it for training and teaching in science and education. And technology to compete with the Soviets on Sputnik and the race to the moon. We took our young people and we appointed the football coach from Oklahoma to be the presidential physical fitness advisor for America. And in the Kennedy administration, young people were encouraged to be physically fit and get a presidential physical fitness badge. And we did a lot of things to try to harness America. We brought tens of thousands of young people here to study and see our ideas. We sent American companies abroad. We even encouraged them to hire local people and then bring them back here for training. Those multinational corporations were America's eyes and ears and ambassadors on the world. All of that was designed to contain the spread of communism and deter the Soviet Union, and it worked. But when we won the Cold War, we lost our strategy. We had no adversary. We lost our purpose in the world. We lost the organizing principles that held American society together and focused us on the outer world. We lost the organizing principles that kept the NATO alliance together. We were in a new world. It was so new that Harvard historian Francis Fukuyama called it the end of history. George Bush proclaimed a new world order. Gabriel Garcia Marquez came to see me in Panama in 1996 and says, "It's the most boring time in history." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because there's no clash of ideas. There's only one idea." I said, "I don't think that's boring." But I was wrong, because there were a lot of other ideas. That period, I was a division commander at Fort Hood, as Jeff said, in 1992-94. I had 350 armored fighting vehicles, 350 tanks, a battalion of Apache helicopters, a battalion of multiple launch rocket systems, three battalions of tube artillery, 17,000 soldiers, and 53 horses. I got to ride horseback twice a week. I had boots that came up to my knees. I used boot picks to get on. I had a windbroke thoroughbred because the Army wouldn't let you pay more than $1,400 for a horse. And I had a big black Stetson with two stars on it. And I actually could gallop and jump, and I loved it. And suddenly I was told I was going to go to Washington, get a third star, and be the director of strategic plans and policy on the joint staff, the highest military staff in the country. My job was to integrate military thinking with diplomatic and political strategy. So I was the guy who took the military strategic plans and went across the Potomac River every day to the White House meetings and had a staff of 300 officers to help me. And we did everything from all geographic areas to space, arms export policy, international treaty and negotiations, and the UN. I had the whole, you might say, what else is anybody doing on the joint staff? But believe me, it's a very busy place, and there are a lot of people doing a lot of things. But I had a huge portfolio. And when I went up there, I didn't know what we were doing because there was no Soviet threat. There was no organizing principle. And so I arrived. It was, I think, the 5th of April, 1994, was my first day. And when I walked in, they handed me three-ring binders stacked up on my desk. They said, "Sir, you have to learn all these." I looked at it, and they were full of acronyms and abbreviations, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. I thought I was going to learn about NATO, but instead they showed me a map, and it had like six lines, and they were all intersecting. They said, "Well, there's NATO, there's the European Union, there's the Western European Union, there's the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, there's the Western Union Treaty Organization." I mean, they went through all these different organizations, and they were all overlapping. He said, "So, let's see, Denmark is a member of the, they're a member of the EU, but they're not a member of the EU monetary, but they're a member of NATO, but they're not a member of the West European Union, but they get to vote in the EU on West European Union defense policy, even though they're not a member." And, you know, there's, you're trying to sort this out, and it was incredibly complicated and confusing, and I'd been there and trying to learn my job. General Schley told me I was supposed to be the person who drove the staff. I was supposed to come up with these ideas. So the second day I was there, I was leaving the office, and somebody said, "Bad news in Africa. We just had a shoot down of an aircraft by a missile. They shot down the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi. It may be our missile." So this was the crisis on Thursday morning, my third day. So it turned out it was a French missile, not an American missile. No problem. I was leaving the office. So I said, "Well, who are these people in Rwanda and Burundi?" He said, "Sir, we don't have time to brief you on it right now, but we'll get on your calendar and come back in and give you the rundown next week." Fine. So on Friday, I was leaving the office. I thought I'd had a full week. My wife was saying, "When are you ever going to be home? When are you going to hang the pictures? When are you going to unpack?" And I had already learned, when every time I went to Shali Kashvili's office, he had CNN on continuously. And I realized the first learning experience was, if you ever want to find out what's happening, you don't ask the National Military Command Center, you watch CNN. So I was leaving the office at 6 o'clock at night on a Friday night. Half the people are gone because they think they can take advantage of me as a newbie on the block, that I won't call them on Friday night if they get out of there, see? And I look, and on the CNN screen, there's fighting. There's soldiers. They're in Africa. It's dark. There are black faces. There are white soldiers. There's explosions. I said, what is this? A war movie or what? And my assistant said, oh, no, there's some action in Kigali or someplace. And it looks like, I think it's the French and maybe it's the Belgians. And so I quickly called the National Military Command Center and said, I'm the new J5. I'm supposed to know everything that's going on in the world. And looks like we got a battle going on in Africa. What's that about? They said, sir, we don't know anything. I said, did you look at CNN? They said, no, sir. So I called the European Command Center in Stuttgart, Germany, and they're supposed to keep up with Africa. I said, what's going on? They said, we don't know anything about it. So I had to call the embassies. Anyway, we were up all night with the State Department trying to figure out what the French and Belgians were doing. On this Saturday morning, I had a 9 o'clock meeting with Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, and they said, if you impress Perry, you may get to go with him on a trip to Korea. So go to this meeting and see what he has to say. So I went in there. And I thought, Korea, I've been there a dozen times. I've been over there. I've trained the troops. I know the war plans. I discovered we were about to go to war with North Korea. It seemed like President Clinton had been there in October of 93. He told the North Koreans they couldn't. He said, no nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. He got home. The CIA said, well, Mr. President, there's been a slight problem. It seems like we may have misled you. Maybe we should have told you earlier, but there's this Korean reactor, and they can take the fuel rods out of it, and if they reprocess them, they could extract plutonium from the spent fuel, and that could make a nuclear weapon, and there could be enough plutonium to make 2 nuclear weapons. But we don't know if they've done this because they won't let the IAEA inspectors look at the reprocessed or non-reprocessed fuel pit to find out if the residue in there has been reprocessed or not. And so we were going to threaten them, and we were going to take them to the U.N., and they said, if you take us to the U.N. and put the sanctions on us, we'll consider it an act of war. And so the generals in Korea called us and said, if they say it's an act of war, it's going to be an act of war. Give us more troops. And this thing was ramping up to be a full-fledged battle. And, I left about 3 hours later from the SecDef's office kind of stunned because none of this was in the press. And on Sunday, I got called into a meeting in the White House. I sat in the back row of the Situation Room. It's a little tiny room about the size of this stage with a little table. And there was a Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, my first meeting with him. And there was Madeleine Albright on a TV screen from New York. She was a U.N. ambassador. And Sandy Berger, the Deputy National Security Advisor. And Tony Lake, the National Security Advisor. And Bill Perry was there again. And Shali Kashvili, my boss, was there. And several other people, the Vice President's National Security Advisor. And they're arguing about the air rules of engagement for flying combat air patrols over Bosnia. And they're talking about what are the criteria which enable them to shoot down Serb aircraft. And they're arguing, well, there's a plane here and there's a plane here, and if he sees the plane, if it turns back to him, and if the radar's on, and what if there's a radar on the ground, and if the radar on the ground, what kind of radar is it, and how does the pilot know the radar's on the ground and tracking him, not tracking? And this discussion goes on, and they're moving like this. I'm sitting there trying to follow this conversation. I got a little stenographer's notebook, and I'm thinking I have to copy everything down. I couldn't follow it. They couldn't follow it. There wasn't an aviator in the room. Nobody understood the technology. We spent 3 hours there on a Sunday afternoon, and we ended with nothing. That was my first weekend. And on Monday morning, a guy came in, knocked on the door. He's a one-star general. He said, sir, I was gone last week. I worked for you. You didn't meet me. My name's Tom Hill. And he said, I have to report something to you. I'm not allowed to tell you this because it's classified information and it's compartmented. And I'm representing you in this compartmented program, but I feel like I ought to tell you anyway. We're planning an invasion of Haiti. And you know, here I come up here, it's the end of the Cold War, I don't know why we have armed forces left, and we're about to go to war with North Korea, we're fighting a war over the Balkans, and we're going to invade Haiti. And it was crazy. And this went on every single weekend with calls and frantic meetings and nothing decided. And after about 6 or 8 weeks of this, Shali Kashvili called me back in, and he said, Wes, he said, look, he said in his Polish accent in English, he says, we hired you to be distrategist because you are supposed to be so smart. So tell us, what is distrategy that has us working every weekend? And it was a joke because there was no strategy. And so we tried to create a strategy. We worked really hard to do it. And we labored for a year and a half to create. There was what do you do after deterrence and containment? There was no obvious threat. We knew that there was a threat of regional war. There was a threat of terrorism. There was a threat of nuclear proliferation. There was a threat if Russia should become hostile. But there was no obvious immediate threat that you could sort of run up the flag and say, look out, here they come again, you know. And so how could you use that to mobilize resources, build alliances? So we really puzzled over this. And we wrote this strategy called a strategy of engagement and enlargement. It was published in 1995. And if you saw the title today of engagement and enlargement, you'd think it was an advertisement for a men's pharmaceutical product. Almost nobody read it. It never became the real national strategy. We were very active. You know, we went to Bosnia. We put 25,000 troops on the ground. We stopped a war. We fought a 78-day air campaign. We bombed Saddam. We bombed Osama bin Laden. We won that war that saved 1.5 million Albanians that I led as NATO commander. And at the end of it all, when I retired in 2000, there was still no national strategy. And in the 2000 presidential election, I remember I was just before I left the military, I came to New York and I heard Ken Black and Bob Shrum, who were managing respectively the George Bush and Al Gore campaigns, debate in front of these prominent French and American business leaders. What would be the 2000 election themes? What were the top five issues? It was like the economy, education, social security reform, and maybe trade, and that was it. There was nothing about national security, nothing, no significant foreign policy issues. No, everything was going great. And then 9/11 happened. And what happened at 9/11 is we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have bipartisan agreement, we didn't have American understanding of it, and we had instead a policy coup in this country, a coup, a policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us. I went through the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. I couldn't stay away from Mother Army. I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I'd worked for him as a White House fellow in the 1970s. All this is in the book. And I said, am I doing okay on CNN? He said, yeah, fine. He said, I'm thinking about it. He says, I read your book, and he said, this is a book that talks about the Kosovo campaign. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody. He said, I'm thinking of calling this a floating coalition. What do you think about that? I said, well, sir, thanks for reading my book. And, he said, thanks. That's all the time I've got. Really? And I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess they don't know what to do about terrorism. And so but they can attack states, and they want to look strong. And so I guess they think if they take down a state, it will intimidate the terrorists. And you know, it's like that old saying, he said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem has to be a nail. Well, I walked out of there pretty upset. And then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office that says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it. And I sat on this information for a long time, for about 6 or 8 months. I was so stunned by this, I couldn't begin to talk about it. And I couldn't believe it would really be true, but that's actually what happened. These people took control of the policy in the United States. And I realized then It came back to me. A 1991 meeting I had with Paul Wolfowitz. You know, in 2001, he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, but in 1991, he was the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. It's the number three position in the Pentagon. And I had gone to see him when I was a one-star general. I was commanding the National Training Center. I had met him one time. He said, if you ever get to Washington, come look me up. They always say that. Well, I was there in Washington. It was a Friday afternoon. I'd visited Colin Powell. He'd given me 5 minutes of his precious time and sent me on my way, and I was bored in the Pentagon. And I thought, I'll just go, who can I see? I think I'll see Wolfowitz. So I called, and up there, he was available. Scooter Libby came to the door. I met Scooter for the first time, and he brought me in. And I said to Paul, and this is 1991, I said, Mr. Secretary, you must be pretty happy with the performance of the troops in Desert Storm. And he said, well, yeah, he said, but not really. He said, because the truth is we should have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, and we didn't. And this was just after the Shia uprising in March of 91, which we had provoked, and then we kept our troops on the sidelines and didn't intervene. And he said, but one thing we did learn, he said, we learned that we can use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. He said, and we've got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet client regimes, Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us. And it was like, you know, I'm coming out of the Mojave Desert. I've been training troops. I haven't been thinking geostrategy for some time. And suddenly a guy just sort of shoves this nugget at you. Well, you remember it. It was a pretty stunning thing. You mean the purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments? It's not to sort of deter conflict? We're going to invade countries, and I, you know, my mind was spinning. And I put that aside. It was like a nugget that you hold on to. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. It went back to those comments in 1991. Now, did anybody ever tell you that? Was there a national dialogue on this? Did senators and congressmen stand up and denounce this plan? Was there a full-fledged American debate on it? Absolutely not. And there still isn't. And that's why we're failing in Iraq. Because Iran and Syria know about the plan. All you have to do is read the Weekly Standard and listen to Bill Kristol, and he blabbermouths it all over the world. Richard Pearl the same way. They could hardly wait to finish Iraq so they could move into Syria. It was like a laydown. Oh, our legions are going to go in there. This wasn't what the American people voted George Bush into office. Well, they didn't actually vote him into office, but it wasn't what many of the people who... It wasn't what he campaigned on. He campaigned on a humble foreign policy, the most arrogant foreign policy in American history. He campaigned on no peacekeeping, no nation building, and here he is with Afghanistan and Iraq. It's astonishing. So the root of the problem is not how many troops are in Iraq. Please believe me. Don't be mad if you're a Democrat at your Democratic congressman because they can't reduce the troops and frustrate the president. That's not the issue. And if you're a Republican, don't be mad at the Democrats because they're fussing with the troops. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you're an American, you ought to be concerned about the strategy of the United States in this region. What is our aim? What is our purpose? Why are we there? Why are Americans dying in this region? That is the issue. For lack of an effective strategy, we're going to lose in this regional battle. Dave Petraeus, he worked for me. He was a fine young officer. He hadn't worked for me as a senior officer. I assume he's very competent. Nobody makes 4 stars in the United States Armed Forces, no matter what Rush Limbaugh says, unless they're pretty good. And Dave Petraeus is good, darn good. But listen, He doesn't hold the cards. The cards for America's success in the region are held by the White House. They have to do with strategy, whether you talk to or isolate Iran, whether you punish or reform Syria, whether you aid or condemn Lebanon, how you motivate Egypt, how you deal with Saudi Arabia. Those are key elements in a strategy, and there has to be a purpose for it, and none of that's been laid out in any coherent way. No, it's all about politics. It's what Karl Rove said in January of 2002 in Las Vegas, Nevada. He said, "We're going to run this president as a war president." And you know what? They're succeeding. The Democratic challenge to Iraq was, in my view, misplaced. We should not have challenged on troop strength or tactics. It's not about troops and tactics. It's about strategy and policy. And we failed on challenging the strategy and policy. And Bush won on troops because he knows he's got the Democrats up against the wall. It's all about politics. If you try to take down the troops, he says you're not supporting the Americans' troops. If you try to challenge what he's doing, he says you don't want to win. And now the rhetoric's heating up against Iran. So where's this going to go? Likely to a strike against Iran. Could be a strike against nuclear, could be billed as a strike against Iran because they're aiding and abetting the insurgents who are fighting and killing Americans. And how many Democratic congressmen do you think will be able to take a strong and principled stand against this? Well, the answer is any Democrats who want to stand up and say, no, I believe Iran has a perfect right to kill and attack American soldiers. Or any congressman who wants to say, no, I favor Iran getting a nuclear weapon. So, do you see, he owns the playing field, the president does. It's not about strategy. It's about politics. It's about election politics. I'm sorry to say. I'm so disappointed. We can't seem to control the dialogue. And I'm out here tonight begging you to help us get this dialogue reoriented in the right direction before it's too late and we're engaged in another and deeper war with more costs, another unnecessary war in this region. What should we be doing? We should send a diplomatic mission to the region. I'd put Richard Holbrooke over there in a heartbeat. Put him on a Gulfstream, give him a general, give him a couple of assistants and say, Dick, see ya. Come back when you got it sorted out. I'm giving you 2 months. Go visit every leader in the region. Talk to Iran. Here's a statement of principles. You can tell them this. If they're good, we'll give them this. If they're bad, we're going to do this. And see if you can make some sense out of this and build some coherence. Iran cannot tolerate a hostile Iraq. We did them a great favor. But Iran is torn between whether it wants to be a revolutionary power and upend everything, or whether it wants to be recognized and admitted to the world community as a major regional power. They just don't know. They've got an ongoing debate, and like any good group, they're going to push in both directions as far as they can until they run into an obstacle, because they'd like to have it both ways. Syria. Well, they'd like to modernize, they'd like to end the conflict with Israel, but on the other hand, they don't have the economic resources, they're under threat, they're trying to maintain an alliance with Iran so they don't get pushed aside, they're at odds with the Saudis, there's no one to make peace. Lebanon, completely ripped apart by internal conflict. Israel, the Palestinians, you know about Hezbollah in the north, but did you know that the Hamas movement is heavily infiltrated by Iran and is preparing in Gaza the same kind of fortifications that the Israelis went against in South Lebanon. So there's a lot of problems in this region. Before we use force or threaten force, we should talk to people in the region. There's no guarantee. But if it were up to me, I'd pull out 2 brigades right now. I'd send that diplomatic mission over, and I'd talk about a big regional strategy. We've got to extricate our resources and change our focus from the Middle East to the broader world around us, because while we're bogged down in terrorism, China and India are growing. They're growing at 10%, or in the case of India, 9% a year. They're developing new technologies, new challenges, new relationships, and we're both customers and competitors of these countries. And we've got our own challenges. We've got to fix education in this country and healthcare and a business environment and reignite American technological ingenuity. We've got to have an energy policy that makes sense and gives us greater flexibility and freedom from dependence on Middle Eastern and Russian oil. We've got to deal with problems that are too big for any one nation to handle, but that are national security problems like global warming and climate change. All of that is being impacted by the politically driven, excessive focus on war in the Middle East. We need a real American strategy. And to get that strategy, it's about who we are as Americans. Are we dividers or uniters? Bullies or people who outreach and make friends? Do we fear others or do we welcome others? Do we build fences around America or build bridges to invite others in to see us? Who are we as a nation? I think we're open. I think we're a nation of immigrants. I think we're a nation of incredible energy, courage, stamina, endurance. Don't ever sell America short. I want you to read my book. I want you to figure out who we are as Americans, and I want you to help me open up this debate into a true dialogue about America's future, not just an argument about 10,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We want to thank General Wesley Clark for his comments this evening, and we've got a lot of questions for you, General, so we'll get started. But we want to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with retired U.S. Army four-star General Wesley Clark, and we're discussing the importance of a strong U.S. foreign policy. I'll get to the big question at the end, which everyone has on their mind here, and I'm sure you already know what it is, but we'll go through some other things right now. One of the big issues, really, of the last election was that at least members of Congress believed the president was sent a pretty strong message about the direction we have been going in Iraq and other places. How do you interpret the Congress's inability to get anything done, given that perspective of a mandate?
Well, the truth is that there are times when you're a chief executive that you have to listen to popular opinion. But there are times when you have to lead and shape popular opinion. And so I don't believe that the President of the United States should always be bound by the latest Gallup poll. There's a certain common sense in the American public. And the American public now recognizes that the war in Iraq was a mistake, that the course we're pursuing is not working, and they'd like to see it changed. But the American public also wants to succeed. They don't want to see us fail. They don't want to see us driven out. And they will certainly hold accountable any American political leadership which results in Osama bin Laden and the thugs in the region claiming they drove us out of Iraq and Americans are weak and incapable. So people are working very carefully through this. Congress is not controlled by the Democrats. I know you might like to think it is in San Francisco, California. It isn't. Actually, there's not a veto-proof majority. And in the Senate, even though we hold the majority position, Joe Lieberman uniformly votes with the Republicans on every issue associated with Iraq, whether it makes sense or not. And I campaigned against Joe. He's no friend of mine. I don't believe he's a Democrat, but I guess it's okay if he wants to say he's an independent Democrat, because at least we get Harry Reid as our majority leader. But don't you hold the Democratic Party accountable, because they don't have the majority in the Senate. So President Bush is the chief executive. He's driving the policy the way he wants to. He's low in the polls, but he's still the chief executive. And think of it from his perspective. Were he to pull out and acknowledge what the Iraq study group said, he'd be looked upon as a failure, as a loser. Some of y'all might want him to be a loser. But I don't want America to lose, and neither do you. What we need is a debate that takes the courage and commitment of the young men and women and applies it in the right strategic direction. We haven't achieved that kind of dialogue yet. The White House can't think the problem through, and the Congress can't seem to ask the right questions to stimulate the appropriate response. It's a real national tragedy. Everybody's mad at everybody else, but we don't have the dialogue we need to find the solution.
Obviously, the war is taking a toll not only on the people at home, but most particularly on the recycling and the constant recycling of troops and the devastation that has not only on them but their families. How do we get out of this cycle and still address your concern of coming out of this with a positive result?
Well, I think that the situation on the ground is not immutable. That is to say, although it looks bad today, you're not seeing it on the inside. Nobody is. We've got 160,000 troops in a nation of 25 million people. There's a thin veneer of American forces. Underneath that veneer, and those forces are formidable forces, we got great intelligence, quick reaction. Our soldiers can shoot and hit the target. Our intelligence people can plot. Our operations people can plan a mission. We can put helicopters in there. We can fly at night. We can shoot straight with lasers. We can drop a bomb and precisely hit a vehicle on a road. I mean, the military technology, the processes, the organizations, they're astonishingly good. The problem is that there's a nation underneath there of 25 million people that we're not part of. The number of American soldiers who can actually be part of that and participate in it is probably less than 100, who speak Arabic, who can maneuver through the area and are educated and sensitive enough to understand the cross current of flows. Here's what I see from a distance. And again, I'm not there either, and I'm not inside that society. But here's what seems pretty obvious to me. The Iranians put a big push on political, economic, cultural, social, religious, educational, medical, technology, everything. Something like 1 million Iraqis lived in Iran and fled there during the 1980s. Those people, a lot of them came back. People move back and forth across that border with impunity, just like people in Michigan think nothing of going to Canada and buying pharmaceutical products. And they, people go back and forth across these borders. They've lived there for centuries. Those borders are new. So Iran doesn't want a hostile Iraq. It's doing everything it can to win. But what we're doing over there is very, very constrained. So underneath the veneer of American forces, Iraqi society is being organized. It's going to look like this a year from now. There's going to be a strong Shia domination in the Basra area and in most of Baghdad and much of central Iraq. It's going to look like Germany with a more jagged division during the Cold War. There'll be an iron curtain or a paper curtain or a wall or something that separates Shia and Sunni. In Anbar province and maybe some parts north of Baghdad, there'll be strong Sunni sheikhs who hold us together. They organize their tribes. They're being funded not by the Americans but by other Sunni nations on the outside. They're building a buffer zone for Saudi Arabia and Jordan so that when the Americans leave and the American mission collapses, the Iranian-backed Shia legions can't come in there and run them out of the country entirely because Saudi Arabia and Jordan want a buffer zone. And there'll be still parts of the country that aren't resolved yet. Casualties will be down, and it won't be long before the Iraqi Shia majority ask us to leave. I mean, after all, we're only doing what they ask us to do. We're getting rid of the Ba'athists, and that was their enemy. And so once that's done, they don't need us. They're not afraid of being invaded by Iran, okay? So what do they need a bunch of Americans for? They're using us for what they can. So don't be mistaken into believing that this failure and all this violence and 100 deaths a month and so forth will continue indefinitely. It won't. A lot of the ethnic cleansing's already been done. But what you'll have is an Iraq that is in all significant aspects divided, in which Iran has made a major encroachment on Iraq and has opened the way for more Iranian destabilization in the region. I think we'll reduce the casualties among American troops, and I think we'll be able to curtail some of the tours, and we'll make it through this, even in the Bush administration. And he'll claim credit for victory. He'll say these withdrawals were his idea.
Speaking of strength, there seems to be a big discrepancy between what the Bush administration lists as hundreds of thousands of trained Iraqi troops and what members of Congress say exist. Can you shed some light on your insights in that arena?
It's hard to train. You know, anybody that thinks you can train an army in a year or two doesn't understand. In the United States Army, after Vietnam, we set up a really structured training program. And we always joke, we say, you know what the longest weapon system it takes to develop is? You know, it takes, you know, like 8 years to develop, design, build, and field a tank. 10 years for an artillery piece. Well, to build a brigade commander takes 24 years. You have to start with a second lieutenant and build him all the way up through the Army system. So how do we think the Iraqis are going to do this in a year or two? They're not going to do it. And they've got the additional problem of divided loyalties. So there's no doubt that we've had our military put a pretty face on some ugly situations. And some of the reports in the early training during the time when we first set up the training command with General Petraeus and others turned out to be pretty inaccurate. They're probably still pretty inaccurate. But the point is that underneath all of that, there's a whole lot of weapons being distributed, and a whole lot of people are getting marksmanship practice, and a whole lot of people have got body armor and helmets. So we prepared the way for a real war if we need one.
As you look at the generals who are now sitting in the seats that you occupied and others who are your colleagues, why don't they get together and publicly state what they really think?
Well, because it would be a violation of their constitutional responsibilities. You take an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and that means loyalty to the Commander-in-Chief. You air your disagreements in private, not in public. If you don't like it, you can retire. If you're a general, nobody keeps you in there, and there's plenty of people who are willing to take those stars if you want to take them off. And so there's no reason for them to go public with their disagreements. They shouldn't. But I think and I hope that they will stand up firmly to political authority and explain what's right and wrong. Because I think if you're a senior officer and you know what is required to do the mission and you're not given the tools or the authorities or the policies and support that's required, I think you have to blow the whistle because you're committing men's and women's lives and welfare in vain. That's your professional integrity that's on the line, and I think that a lot of the people, younger people in the armed forces say the generals have a lot to answer for. I don't know that. I know a lot of the generals. A lot of them work for me. I like them and admire them. But there'll have to be a major sorting out period as this conflict winds down because these charges and suspicions and concerns do have to be answered, not publicly necessarily.
Some in our audience are asking questions related to the whole rollout of our military force today and whether or not we should return to a draft. What's your thought on that?
Volunteer Army is a great concept for the Army. Can you imagine being in an organization and having people struggling to escape? They call that a prison. During the Vietnam War, in any company of 100 men, there were probably one or two AWOL at any given time. If a guy came in and said, "Sarge, I got a back problem," you didn't know whether he had a back problem or not. And in those days, you couldn't walk in and say, "I'm having a strange feeling about Private Smith, who's in the squad with me, and I'd like to be discharged." because if you could have done that, they would have discharged probably half the Army that didn't want to go to Vietnam. So we got real choosy and we're real selective. And in the United States Army today, we say, if you don't want to be there, you won't be. We only want people who want to be here. And we've got a very, very competent group of people who are highly motivated to do the job, and they believe in each other. They stay with each other. They know each other's personally. It's like a huge football team in there, and they're fighting to win. It's the best Army we've ever had. It's not necessarily the best thing for the country, because I think when an Army gets divorced or separated from the population, and the majority of the people don't feel an obligation to it, I think it does create tensions and expose the nation to certain risks. So I hope we'll find some middle path, but I don't think it's likely we're going to go back to the draft. It's simply not a politically palatable solution to either party.
We're currently building a new massive U.S. embassy in the Green Zone in Baghdad. Should we be?
Well, I think it's prudent to do that. I wouldn't tell them to live in tents and take mortar attacks and rocket attacks. And so right now, that mission in Baghdad is the largest mission in the world. It's got all kinds of advisors in there. They need a place to work. They need to be secure. Why not? You can always pull out of it. It's only a piece of masonry. So, but why expose your troops to danger on the basis of, so you can say, gee, we're not really going to be here permanently with this large a mission. It's only money. It's not the lives. And we're trying to protect the lives of our people who serve there.
We're doing a much better job of that. You yourself were severely wounded in Vietnam and were a survivor, but a lot of folks in that conflict did not. We're doing an incredible amount of life-saving on the field of battles today. But that, too, has a cost after troops return home. Are we properly addressing their needs, given what transpired at the hospital in Washington and the fact that the response to the whole issue of IED and brain injury wasn't recognized early?
No, we're not doing an adequate job. It's a real tragedy. I mean, there's wonderful doctors and medical personnel, and they're doing the best they can. And Walter Reed, despite what you may have read in the Washington Post, for the outpatients, when you're in it and you're receiving the surgical care and so forth, it's pretty wonderful care. The problem is that people return with lifetime problems, and they go through a transition from the Army system to the VA system to and out of the military environment into the civilian environment, and they don't have the same standards of care. We've got a lot of people in the National Guard and Reserve who come back, and they're bumped off active duty, and then they have accumulated injuries and back injuries and other problems, and they can't get medical attention. They lose their TRICARE system, support through the TRICARE health insurance program that the active duty has. And then we end up with a series of mental issues we call post-traumatic stress syndrome, and these are clearly not being addressed adequately. I had knowledge of a terrible situation in Iowa in the fall of 2005. A young man returned from a deployment in Iraq, a National Guard soldier. About a month before his deployment ended, his best friend was killed in the unit by an improvised explosive device. He wasn't killed. He got home in time to celebrate his 21st birthday, and it was around Thanksgiving. And a couple of weeks later, the parents knew he'd been acting strange, and he couldn't seem to adjust. He wasn't communicative. He seemed to be moody. But, you know, people are moody. Children are moody sometimes, and they didn't know exactly what to make of it. And one morning, as his mother was going into the bathroom to take a shower, she noticed him leaving and in uniform. And she saw that he'd left a note on the kitchen counter. It said, "Mom, don't worry. Everything will be okay." And she's saying, "Oh, that's a nice note." And then she's thinking, what does that mean? And she raced out in her bathrobe, and she saw her son sitting in the front seat of his pickup truck with a pistol pointed at his head, and he pulled the trigger and blew his brains out in front of his mother. He could never quite accept the guilt, the shame, the shock, the horror, the anger, and a whole welter of emotions associated with the loss of his friend in that convoy. And without professional help, a lot of people have these problems. I was giving a speech in New Hampshire a year ago, and a woman came up to me and she said, "Oh, my father would have really liked to have heard you. He was a Vietnam vet." I said, "Well, where is he?" And what happened to him? She said, well, he died in 1985. I said, what did he die of? She said, post-traumatic stress syndrome. I said, he died of this? She said, yes, he was a helicopter door gunner. He'd seen a lot of action. He'd been shot down a couple of times. And when he got back in 1970, everything seemed to be okay. But he went through a succession of jobs, and it turned out he couldn't hold the jobs. And in the end, she said, he would drink, and he would just sit on the couch all day with the television set on and shake. And he died. Post-traumatic stress disease is a killer. It doesn't kill you right away. It can kill you later. And that's my biggest concern on our lack of care for the returning veterans.
As we look at the toll that this is taking, we have taken our eyes, as you mentioned in your comments, off of other issues we should be facing domestically. Certainly during the Vietnam era, we had the Great Society activities President Johnson and others were involved in. How do we find a balance so that some of these other issues that the American public and that you mentioned are of real concern can get addressed?
Well, it's a matter of leadership, and we've got to find a way to reduce those expenditures on the Iraq War. We've got to back our soldiers out of there. We've got to reorient some of our priorities to reestablish America's competitiveness. We've got huge infrastructure needs. How huge? Maybe $100 billion. Oh, well, that's half of what Bob Gates asked for this year's budget. We've got needs in homeland security, maybe $100 billion to make our ports secure and really check cargo on aircraft. Well, if you added the homeland security needs with the other needs, you'd come up with what we're spending this year in Iraq. So there's a lot of money out there. Now, President Bush today, he vetoed the Child's Health Insurance Program expansion. But we can afford the war in Iraq. Can we? At that expense of 9 million children who don't have health insurance? Listen, in Arkansas, we had a free dental clinic. 40 dentists came together, went to Joe T. Robinson Auditorium and said, anybody who wants dental care? There was a line of like 4,000 people who showed up to try to get dental care. You can't believe how many young people in this country don't ever see a dentist, and who in their 20s and 30s have rotting teeth. It's unbelievable. In the wealthiest country of the world, we have urgent needs. These dental problems and health problems are serious. They affect national health. They affect productivity. They affect education. They affect our ability to compete in the international arena. They affect even the people who are ready and able to serve in our armed forces. Surely we can attend to these kinds of priorities. We have to have our priorities changed. It's that simple.
Many of our allies around the world, including Canada, Australia, even Israel, do not have restrictions on gays in the military. What policy should replace the current policy? And what's your sense of the value of the current policy?
Well, I think the current policy should be replaced. I think the Brits replaced theirs with something, instead of don't ask, don't tell, I think it was something like don't misbehave. And then you have to define what that means, and there's some arguing about what that means exactly. But it should be about conduct, and conduct that's prejudicial to the good order and discipline of the armed forces. And that applies to all kinds of behavior. And that's the appropriate standard.
Let's turn to the 2008 presidential election.
All righty.
Are you going to run?
No.
Would you accept the post in the next administration if it were the right party?
Well, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves. You know, it's just a long way from here to there. I think what we need is a good dialogue in America to help us make the right decision on who the president's going to be in the next period. And then we'll figure out, let that president pick his or her cabinet.
Do you have any ideas on who that may end up being?
Yes, I do. I've endorsed Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I endorsed Hillary Clinton because I think she's the most talented, capable, experienced person in the race. She's very smart. She's got a lifetime record of achievement. And one of the things I learned in the business community about picking people, I said, if you ever want to pick a top executive in a business, go back and look at their record of achievement going back to high school. Go back and look at Hillary's record. It's phenomenal. She's going to achieve great things if she's given the opportunity to be president. But she's got enormous experience. She was there through all the problems of a governorship, all the problems of the presidency. She was an active partner to her husband. She's a senator. She's seen it from the legislative side. She's a lawyer. She's very effective. She does her homework. She's the best person we could have lead this country who's in this race, and she's going to be a great president. And so I'm a strong supporter of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I want you all to vote for her and campaign actively for her and give her the money and resources she needs to win this election. I mean, I'm asking you to do that because I think she'll be a great president for this country.
That's the other question. Would you consider being on that ticket with her?
You know, that's something that's just totally premature to address, and I'm very flattered that you asked the question, but she has to make that decision. She and her closest advisors, they have to determine what she needs in terms of being elected and running the country, and these are not easy decisions to make, and I'm sure she'll make the right decision for the country if she becomes a nominee.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with retired U.S. Army four-star General Wesley Clark. General Clark, you have endorsed Hillary. Were you disappointed at all with her yes vote on the recent Iranian Revolutionary Guard?
No, I think she voted the right. Look, you couldn't say they aren't terrorist organizations. You know, she voted to say that the Iraqi Special Guards were Revolutionary Guards were a terrorist organization. Well, they are. They're training people in terrorism. Then they have cells that execute terrorist activities. I mean, it's just clear as the nose on your face. Now, the question is, what next? And that's why she and Jim Webb put a resolution in that called for Congress to prevent the president from taking military action against Iran without coming back to the United States Congress. And I hope it'll be followed by other resolutions which require the administration actually to use America's secret weapon against Iran, which is our ability to talk. If we would have a dialogue with Iran, we might find we don't have to drop bombs on Iran. But that requires leadership.
What is your take on the current situation with immigration in the U.S. and the barriers that we're putting in place and have?
Well, first of all, I mean, we are all a nation of immigrants. Almost every one of us has someone in our family who came from overseas. You mentioned my grandparents came from Russia, and I'm very proud of them. I think it takes a lot of courage to leave familiar territory, no matter how poor and oppressed you are, to go to a new land. That's tough. And millions of people do it. They vote with their feet. They believe in the promise of America. They're coming here to help our country. I think we ought to have an open policy. We ought to welcome people in. Obviously, we want talented people, motivated people, law-abiding people, people who will become part of our society and be good Americans. But we're a nation of diversity, and I'm a strong believer in the value of immigration. I'd like to see us get rid of the problem of the system that causes people to come in without documentation, to stay here and hide out, to use false Social Security numbers so they won't be caught, to avoid paying taxes because they don't have real Social Security numbers and can't be tracked and so forth. That system needs to be worked. I'm in favor of an earned citizenship program, and I'm in favor of strengthening our controls on the border, especially through what we call a virtual border fence, through improved electronic surveillance and other measures and strengthening the border patrol. It is a matter of homeland security. We do have to do this, but we shouldn't try to change our character. One of our greatest strengths has been we've always brought new people to America, and each successive wave of immigration has helped us to reinterpret the American dream and to realize it in new and different ways and to bring new energy and new talent, new creativity into this country. And God help us if we ever lose that.
General Clark, we're unfortunately reached the point of the program where there's only time for one more question, and this one is kind of multifaceted. One, should Rush Limbaugh be replaced by Al Franken on Armed Forces Radio and Television? Secondly, what role should and could the media play in helping with the dialogue that you talked about, and how do we change the way in which we elect people with 30-second messages? All in two minutes.
It's a very strange media environment. I mean, first of all, the media is not liberal. And the strongest voices in the media come from the right, not from the left. The right drives the media agenda. And if you look at the range of the dialogue and go back to 1990 and look at it over a period of 18 years, you'll find that the spectrum has shifted progressively toward the right and narrower and narrower. And so this is harmful to a full discussion of the issues. The level of invective and odious comments in the media is pretty high. And I didn't support the kind of attack on General Petraeus in the New York Times advertisement. I thought it was a waste of time for Congress to pass a resolution. I thought that was a distraction from what they should be doing, which is debating on the policy. But it was their idea to deal with these odious comments and to take a firm stand to condemn them. So if that's the case, then I think that a right-wing shock jock like Rush Limbaugh, who calls soldiers who are serving in Iraq or have served elsewhere, who simply don't agree with his political beliefs, he calls them phony soldiers. Well, I don't think a guy like that should be sponsored on Armed Forces Radio and providing education and entertainment for the troops. He wants to be on elsewhere and take his chance at censure like everybody else does, fine. The media blitz that MoveOn put in, that was paid for in the New York Times. Rush is not paying for his time on Armed Forces Network. You are. And you're paying for someone who is saying that people who aren't politically correct in his definition aren't real soldiers. And I think that's a slur on every man and woman in the armed forces. They're entitled to their private political beliefs, and they're entitled to have those beliefs respected and their privacy maintained, and they don't need Rush Limbaugh. You know, Rush is, he came across when he started 20 years ago as a guy who was not afraid to take on the high and mighty, but there's been a big change. He is the high and mighty, and when he steps on the little guy, like he's stepping on our soldiers like this, I think it's time to blow the whistle and cry foul, and that's what I've done.
Our thanks to retired U.S. Army General, former presidential candidate, and author of A Time to Lead, Wesley Clark, for his insights today. We thank all of you here in our audience, as well as those tuning in via radio, for your time and attention. I'm Jeff Clark, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.